Chapter 3, Emotions and the Brain, The Master of Ceremonies of Emotion in Both You and Your Dog. I met Bo Peep when she was an 8-week-old fluffball who grinned and thumped her tail as I approached. She lay curled up in the barn, close to the sheep that Great Pyrenees dogs like her were bred to protect. There was no worry that she'd get into the trouble common to young pups, playing too hard with the lambs or eating the grain meant for their hungry mamas. Bo Peep was born with back legs so crippled that she couldn't stand up. She could move only by hauling her hips forward with her front legs. After 2 months of life with little chance to develop muscle, that wasn't far. Euthanasia was a reasonable consideration, and her breeders had discussed it at length, but they couldn't bring themselves to put her down, so they called a veterinarian to discuss their options. Bo Peep's back legs didn't work because her kneecaps were on the sides of her legs rather than the fronts. The problem could be fixed surgically, although this major operation was usually done on small dogs, not ones that grow up to weigh over 100 pounds. Their vet said he'd give the surgery a try as long as they understood the outcome was uncertain. He was sure about one thing: Bo Peep would need extensive rehabilitation during her long recovery. The breeders had full-time jobs, several young children, and about a dozen Great Pyrenees. That's where I came in. One horrible day, I lost 29 ducks to a stray dog, not long after a neighbor lost a calf to coyotes. The rolling hills of southern Wisconsin may not look like a dangerous wilderness, but stray dogs and coyotes are common. After my own loss and after neighbors regaled me with stories of attacks on their horses, goats, and chickens, I started looking for a working guard dog. Only one problem. My flock of 8 ewes was worth about $800, and I couldn't afford the $2,000 to $3,000 it cost to buy a mature, working Great Pyrenees. Bo Peep's breeders knew my story and thought they'd found the perfect solution. "You could have her for free," they told me on the phone, "and the vet will do the surgery for only the cost of materials." Bo Peep would need a tremendous amount of care, they said, but with luck, she'd grow up to be a happy, functional guard dog. "Well, I'll come look at her," I said, as if meeting a helpless, fluffy white puppy would help me make an objective decision. I don't need to tell you what happened next. If you care enough about dogs to be reading this book, then you know that my fate was already sealed. Granted, after I met her, I said I'd go home and think about it, maintaining the pretense of making a carefully considered decision. I thought about it all right. I couldn't think about anything else all night long. I brought her home the next day. Weeks later, I watched in fascination as the vet cut open Bo Peep's leg, filed grooves in the bones for the appropriate tendons, and then, straining and groaning, his foot on the table for leverage, pulled her kneecap into place. After a few weeks of recovery in a cozy pen in the barn, it was time for Bo Peep to begin walking on her first newly repaired back leg. We had decided to do one surgery at a time. But Bo Peep had never walked on her back legs, and things didn't turn out as expected. No amount of coaxing or luring could motivate her to take even a single step. Bo Peep had spent her entire life, short as it may have been thus far, lying in one place within a flock of sheep, licking the faces of lambs who came to visit, and thumping her tail when humans approached. For the life of me, I couldn't get her to try to use her new leg. Somehow I had to get her walking. During one frustrating attempt, I carried her a few feet away from the barn, perhaps just to get us both into the warmth of the sun. For the first time in her life, Bo Peep was out of sight of sheep, and finally she was motivated to try to move. She began pulling with her front legs in an attempt to get back to her sheep, and I was able to curl my arms around her hips and lift her hindquarters so that her new hind leg could straighten and begin to carry her weight. Thus began my personal weightlifting routine at Red Start Farm. 2 sessions a day, 10 to 20 times each, I picked up Bo Peep and carried her away from the sheep. First 5 feet, then 10, then 20. Once she began to rock forward, I lifted up her hindquarters to get her started, and then cheered as she took first one step, then two, on her new leg. After a few shaky steps, she'd collapse, and I'd pick her up again and lug her back to where she started. She accepted all this as she did everything in life, cheerfully and sweetly, licking my face as I carried her across the grass. As the months went on, the distance increased. Regrettably, so did her weight. I gave up somewhere around 65 pounds, having developed an impressive set of muscles and a tired back. We did the surgery on her other leg 4 or 5 months later. This time, things didn't go so well. She seemed to be in more pain than after the first surgery, and it was harder to keep her immobile during recovery. A large metal pin didn't stay in place. I found her one morning with it thrust out of her skin like a dagger. Subsequent x-rays found that not only had her kneecap been out of place, but her thigh bone was curved like a bow and couldn't support her leg even with a repaired knee. She would have needed a minimum of 2 more major surgeries to attempt a repair, with only a microscopic chance of success. As it was, her deformed leg was dragging underneath her good one and impeding her progress. Appalled at the choices, I finally accepted the inevitable and had the problem leg amputated. This was Bo Peep's 3rd major surgery in 9 months, and it took its toll. She looked pathetic for days after her surgery, her eyes filled with pain and a kind of weariness rarely seen in young animals. But I was buoyed by the knowledge that 3-legged dogs usually thrive once they've healed. Someone showed me a video of a working cattle dog who'd had a similar surgery. It wasn't until he got a few feet from the camera that I realized he wasn't running on 3 legs. He was running on 2, a foreleg on the left side and a hind leg on the right. Amazing. I kept that image close to me while Bo Peep recovered. She was young and otherwise healthy, and once we had gotten her useless leg out of the way, she had every chance of being a happy and fully mobile teenager. That's not what happened. She recovered from the amputation, but she never walked more than a few steps on her remaining surgically repaired hind leg. The vets couldn't explain it because the leg looked sound in the x-ray films. The University of Wisconsin Veterinary Medical Teaching Hospital even used the x-rays to illustrate the ideal surgical resolution to her problem. Everything was in the right place. Bones, tendons, and cartilage all lined up perfectly for a fully functioning leg. But Bo Peep never used her leg for more than 10 or 12 steps. She'd stand up and walk forward a few steps, then flop her hips sideways down to the ground and drag them like a seal. Finally, I figured out that it wasn't her leg that was the problem. It was her brain. It seemed reasonable to focus on Bo Peep's leg as the source of the problem. After all, that was the part of her that didn't seem to be working. But as John Rady has said in no uncertain terms, separating the body and the brain is rapidly coming to be seen as ridiculous. What the brain becomes and how it functions to control your emotions turns out to be influenced as much by the body and its early experience as the body is influenced by the brain. This is true for both people and dogs, and is one of the many things that make doggy brains much like ours. In spite of a perfect surgery, Bo Peep's leg could never function normally because the connections between her brain and that part of her body weren't made when they were needed, when her brain was developing into its final form. She managed well enough, having learned to drag her hindquarters with her strong shoulders and front legs, but she never fully recovered from growing up without the right connections between her back legs and her brain. This interplay between body and brain is as important for emotions as it was for Bo Peep's legs. Our emotional life and that of our dogs is profoundly affected by how the brain develops early in life, and thus how it functions once we've matured. Our emotional experiences are not only centered in both the brain and the body, they are a vital link between the two. Because the brain's role is so important in the regulation and experience of emotion, it's impossible to understand how our emotions compare with those of our dogs unless we get to know the brain a little bit better. Use it or lose it. One of the most amazing aspects of the brain is its development. Far from being fully formed at birth, brains are like software programs designed to be customized once they've been taken home from the store. What happens after birth literally creates who you and your dog become as adults, because the way a brain functions once it matures is dependent upon the information it receives as it develops. If parts of the body aren't used during early development, the brain discards the connections that control them, either eliminating them entirely or assigning them to other duties. Use it or lose it turns out to be a prophetic phrase. When we are young, our brains are busy creating travel routes for the signals that link them with our bodies. These connections aren't just direct routes from the brain to a limb or an organ. They also include complex pathways among interconnected nerve cells within the brain. If nothing travels on them, these pathways become like unused trails in the woods, filling up with scrubby weeds and bushes, eventually unusable even by the most intrepid of travelers. That's what happened to Bo Peep. Not having received enough signals from her hind legs when it should have, her brain moved on and instead created more internal wiring to direct her massive shoulders and front legs. At birth, the brains of both people and dogs are a little like tropical jungles, in which plants struggle against one another to fight for sunlight. In the brain, the limiting resource isn't sunlight, it's connections to other cells, and neurons that don't use connections early on are overwhelmed and ultimately eliminated by those that do. The brains of human children provide innumerable examples. We know that the neurological circuits managing their muscles are completed at age 2. If, for some tragic reason, a child isn't able to move her arms or legs by then, she'll never be able to. Babies born with cataracts will never be able to see if the corrective surgery is done after 6 months of age, because that's when the wiring system for vision is completed. It's as if the workmen for that project picked up their tools and went home, and once they're gone, it's too late to call them back. The importance of this early wiring project goes far beyond the functioning of body parts. The tangle of trails between your brain cells is as essential to your emotional life as it is to the movement of your body, and is equally affected by what happens during development. For example, the psychiatrist Dan Stern has found evidence for critical periods in the development of emotion, just as there seem to be critical periods for the development of eyes and limbs. Stern found that babies whose parents responded to them with expressions of delight formed more connections within the circuits that generated positive emotions. On the other hand, a baby whose parents react to him or her with horror becomes hardwired to experience negative emotions more easily than positive ones. It's not just that the baby learns a particular behavior early on. He or she actually ends up with a completely different brain, depending on that early experience. This interplay between emotions, brain circuitry, and experience occurs only in children between the ages of 10 months and 18 months, which suggests that there is a critical period for an individual's emotional software. The importance of touch. The implications of this knowledge are vital to the development of healthy people and dogs. We learned this lesson the hard way, from watching baby after baby die in orphanages in the 1930s and 1940s. It had been found that 100% of the babies in orphanages were dead by the age of 2, often from diseases like cholera or scarlet fever. See Deborah Bloom's amazing book, Love at Goon Park, for a riveting account of the extreme and often tragic measures taken to prevent the spread of disease. Concerns about germs were rampant, so caretakers were told to avoid touching the babies and to keep the rooms as empty and as clean as possible. Babies lay alone in their cribs with nothing to look at but an unchanging ceiling for months or years on end. They may have been protected from diseases, but many of them died anyway, because babies need physical affection and environmental stimulation to thrive. Those who died might have been the lucky ones. The survivors were so damaged they had no chance of a normal life, even if they eventually found their way into loving homes. We should have known better. As early as the 13th century, the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II isolated babies to see whether they'd start talking without ever having heard the spoken word. Nurses could feed the babies, but were forced to avoid all other contact with them. Frederick never was able to answer his question. The poor things all died before they would have been able to speak. In recent decades, through experiments on the hard-working laboratory rat, we have begun to understand what happens to those children in orphanages and in Frederick's experiment. The brain simply can't develop normally without a great range of stimulation, from different types of touch to a variety of noises and things to look at. Touch is just one sense that must be stimulated early on for normal development, but as we saw, it's a critical one. Brain scans of touch-deprived babies show that normally busy areas of their brains are alarmingly quiet. It took a few years for hospitals to realize that's why premature babies in incubators weren't thriving. Their brains were being starved of the input necessary for them to grow and function. Touch is so important that if massaged 3 times a day, babies born prematurely gain 47% more weight than if not. Touch does more than help the brain manage the body. It is critical to the development of a healthy emotional system later in life. That early development has important effects on the emotional lives of adults appears to be true across the board in all mammals, from mice to mastiffs to the man next door. The more baby rats are gently handled by their keepers, the more serotonin they produce and the less aggressive they are as adults. The same correlation is found in human societies. Cultures in which people avoid cuddling their children are also cultures in which people are relatively aggressive as adults, while members of societies who receive a lot of gentle touch when young tend to be less violent when they grow up. As anyone who has considered throwing their computer out the window knows, aggressive behavior is highly correlated with strong emotion. So these are important findings for us all. The story that follows is a tragic example of the interplay between aggression, emotions, and the development of the brain. Frisco, a 5-week-old pit bull mix, was in the middle of a full-blown seizure when detectives found him during a drug bust in Madison, Wisconsin. His owners thought it would be fun to give him cocaine and see how he liked it. He didn't. His young, fragile brain went into overdrive, and the electrical storms within it almost killed him. He teetered on the edge of death for 5 days, pulled through, and was rescued by Karen, a kind-hearted woman who fell in love with his sweet face and his sad history. I met him a year later when she brought him in for possession-related aggression. Eager for me to see what he did, Karen dumped an entire bag of toys on the floor and said, "Now watch." I couldn't do anything but, because Frisco's response was so dramatic. He became stiff as a board, shot his head up to look directly into my eyes, and began snarling and growling like a revved-up motorcycle. Although his behavior was extreme in its intensity, stiffening and growling are typical of dogs who are possessive about their toys. But while staring directly into my eyes, Frisco squatted and emptied his bladder, his hindquarters shaking like a frightened puppy's. Saliva drooled out of his mouth and pooled on the carpet at his feet. Frisco was a cauldron of conflicting emotions, from extreme rage to extreme fear. Even though I've seen thousands of dogs in my office, I'll never forget Frisco's face at that moment. His eyes were bulging almost out of his head, and they looked, well, crazy. I've always found eye expressions the hardest thing about dogs to describe objectively, and all I can say about Frisco's eyes is that they looked purely and simply insane. I remember thinking that this had to be one of the most dangerous dogs I'd ever met. Every time Karen or I moved, even to turn our heads, Frisco lunged forward and his growls got louder. Needless to say, for a while we stayed still, concentrating on breathing normally and keeping our own bodies as relaxed as we could. I finally found I could slowly edge my way to the door as long as I moved in tiny increments, feeling guilty about leaving Karen in the room with him, but knowing that movement was what set Frisco off, I elected to be the one to edge out the door. I made it out in one piece and gathered more toys with which to lure him into another room. It worked. Once away from his own treasures, he calmed down in a matter of minutes and went back to being the cheerful, handsome boy he had been before. After Frisco had settled down, Karen and I spoke at length about how much damage the early weeks of his life had done to his brain, and my concerns about his prognosis. It seemed likely that Frisco's extreme reaction was related to the abuse his brain had endured early in life. That meant it was impossible to know how much the usual treatment techniques would help, but she was willing to try, and I was committed to doing all I could to help her. I sent her home with some techniques that help most resource guarding dogs, and with the obvious instruction to put away anything that even vaguely resembled a toy. Even so, I was so worried about her and Frisco that I gave her my home phone number and told her to call me night or day if she needed help. She did, at 11 o'clock that Friday night. I picked up the phone to hear Karen, panicked, whispering like a kidnapped victim who has sneaked away from her abductors to call 911. "Please come help me. Frisco's gone crazy and is stalking me. I've hidden upstairs, but he's trying to get through the door, and I don't know how long it will hold up. I can't get out the windows, and I'm terrified he's going to kill me." I immediately called Esther Rasmussen, a friend and animal control officer who loves dogs, especially pit bulls. Smart, brave, and able to stay calm in a crisis, Esther leapt to the challenge. She knew as well as I that there are thousands of sweet, loving pit bulls in the world, but that an aggressive one, because of the breed's stamina and power, is not to be taken lightly. We met each other after midnight on the street in front of Karen's house, armed with a dart gun, a syringe full of tranquilizer, and a rabies pole. Rabies poles have a loop at the end that allows you to lasso a dangerous dog. The rigid pole keeps the dog a safe 3 or 4 feet away while you restrain him. We could talk to Karen by cell phone and see her frightened face in the second-story window. We pounded on the front door to lure Frisco away from her, and sure enough, he charged down the stairs and attacked the front door. As he barked and lunged, I opened the front door just enough for him to get his head out, and then instantly shut it to stop his shoulders from coming through. Esther snagged him with the loop on the rabies pole and then handed it to me while she prepared the dart gun. Frisco stood still, sides heaving, drooling, and snarling. I silently prayed my weak back would hold up long enough to keep him from pulling the pole out of my hands. Esther fiddled with the dart gun, to no avail. Finally, she said, "Don't let him get me," moved directly to his hindquarters, and jammed the syringe into his hip. I held on for dear life, appalled at the thought that I might not be able to stop him from turning and biting her. Frisco tried his best to bite Esther, but to our mutual relief, she got away in time. Esther's aim had been true, and in just minutes Frisco's eyes went soft. We removed the loop restraining him and cradled his sagging body in our laps. We gently carried him into the van and, at Karen's request, drove him to an emergency vet clinic to be euthanized. Overwhelmed with both adrenaline and sadness, Karen, Esther, and I stroked Frisco while he slipped off to his final rest. Karen had done all she could to give him a good life, but I told her then, and I'll repeat it now, Frisco's first owners had killed him long ago when they fried his poor young brain. It just took him a long time to die. This true story, as tragic as it is dramatic, speaks to the terrible harm that can be done to the developing brain of a young dog. Once Frisco became emotionally aroused, the arousal increased until he became physiologically out of control. Arousal, like many other aspects of physiology in mammals, is regulated by mechanisms much like the thermostat on the furnace in your home. It's the thermostat that keeps your furnace from staying on all the time. Once the temperature rises to a certain level, a feedback system kicks in and the heat is turned off. As the air in the house cools, then becomes too cold, the furnace kicks in again. In a healthy dog, emotional arousal is regulated in a similar way, with what are called the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems acting like thermostats to keep the body and brain functioning at optimal levels. But the body and brain can spiral out of control if the circuits that control this kind of feedback don't have a chance to develop normally. Of course, most stories aren't as extreme as Frisco's, but I've seen too many dogs whose emotional health has been permanently damaged because their developing brains don't have the right environment in which to grow. Illegal drugs are not the only means of compromising a dog's developing brain. Sterile, unstimulating environments can stunt a dog's emotional growth so that he is never able to cope with stress of any kind. Harsh, abusive situations in puppyhood can hardwire a dog to be emotionally overreactive as an adult. Of course, there are many reasons besides early development for the behavioral problems described above, but it's important to include development as one piece of the puzzle. cleanliness is not enough. Many people know something about the importance of environmental stimulation for young children, but often we fail to apply that knowledge in picking or raising a puppy. I've seen any number of clients who raved about the cleanliness of the kennel where they got their pup, but who had no idea of what the pup experienced after birth. Cleanliness is next to godliness in America, and I've learned that clean and neat is what people look for when they're choosing a place to buy a pup. Clean is good, I'm all for it, but it's not enough to ensure that your pup has really had a good start in life. The extreme of clean is sterile, and sterility, it turns out, is a good thing only if you're doing surgery. Sterility can equal environmental deprivation, and that can cause no end of trouble to a developing pup. Environmental deprivation can happen anywhere. It can disable puppies born in filthy puppy mills, as well as those raised in spotless kennels. Clean or dirty, if dogs grow up with little environmental stimulation, they can turn into adults who are lacking in the ability to handle even minor stress. Stress is just change, after all, and if a pup has matured in an environment that never changes, she doesn't develop a brain that is wired to cope with it. Numerous studies on rats and non-human primates show that barren environments create individuals who are unable to cope with stress as adults, because the stress-related pathways in the brains aren't able to develop normally. Rats, who were taken away from their mothers for 15 minutes a day, turn out to be less reactive to stressful events than those that weren't. In an interesting link to our earlier discussion on the importance of touch, that result appears to be related to the amount of intensive licking that the mother rats do when the baby rats are returned. Rats raised in the standard sterile boxes used in most laboratories have fewer connections between their brain cells and thinner cerebral cortexes than rats raised in enriched boxes. This is so important and yet so often ignored that I had to sneak toys into the kennels when I was doing research on dogs and their responses to different types of sound. I had 4 litters of puppies growing up in kennels in the middle of the University of Wisconsin campus, and was committed to raising healthy, normal dogs. That was important to me, not just for their sake, which would have been important enough, but also for my research. Research on the behavior of abnormal dogs wouldn't be meaningful, so I wanted to ensure that the pups had plenty to feel, hear, and see as they grew. As it should, the university has strict regulations on the care of animals and research, but at that time, the rules were all about cleanliness and physical safety. The kennels had to be spotless, but heaven forbid we should bring in a germ-laden toy or chew stick that would facilitate normal development. As a lowly graduate student, I knew that my chances of getting the regulations changed were negligible. I'd already pushed the envelope by creating a legal document that allowed my pups to be the first research dogs at the university to be adopted out into private homes, instead of being euthanized at the end of the research project. There are just so many battles you can fight at one time, so I picked up the toys whenever I thought the lab might be inspected, and put them down when I thought the coast was clear. That was a long time ago, and I'm happy to say that even at that time, some people were acknowledging and acting on the importance of an enriched environment to captive animals. Although I'd argue that we have much to do to improve the lives of many research animals, some of the most impressive advances in creating enriched environments for developing animals have actually come from laboratories and zoological parks. Ironically, the general public, responsible for the lives of over 60 million dogs a year in just the United States alone, is often less aware of enrichment's importance. My associates and I often see dogs who were raised in conditions designed to handicap the development of their minds, not encourage it. These poor dogs can't handle change of any kind, and depending on their genetics, they either slink into the office in terror or roar in like freight trains off the tracks. There's always a lot that can be done to help dogs like this. Brains are amazing things, and some rewiring is possible if you have the time and the patience. But just like a house built on a shaky foundation, the result is never as solid as it would be if you started out right from the beginning. I don't want to discount the importance of genetics here. It plays a big role in who a dog is and how his or her brain reacts to the environment. you can usefully compare genetics with the ingredients in a recipe and the effect of the environment with the method of putting them all together. The best eggs in the world aren't going to make a good omelet if you hard-boil them before you mix them with the other ingredients. Sesame Street for Dogs. Good breeders know about the importance of environmental enrichment and work hard to stimulate their puppies daily from birth. That includes ensuring that the puppies get lots of handling from the day they're born. Although pups are born deaf and blind, their sense of touch is fully developed at birth, and if their brains are to develop normally, their bodies must receive lots of physical contact. I've always suspected that's why single pups, with no littermates to poke into and push against, sometimes grow into adults who are much more touch-sensitive than pups with littermates. The impact of gentle handling can be seen even if it occurs before birth. Puppies born to mothers who were petted during pregnancy tend to be more receptive to handling after birth. The research on the effects of environmental stimulation and the ability to handle stress got a lot of attention a few years back from the U.S. military. In search of dogs who could perform difficult tasks under stressful conditions, the military developed a method of early sensory stimulation that they believe created adult dogs with superior problem-solving abilities and more tolerance of stress. The process takes only a few minutes a day and involves 5 simple exercises to be done on each pup in the litter from birth to 13 days old. The pup should be picked up in one hand and be tickled between the toes of one foot for just 3 to 5 seconds. Next, use both hands to hold the pup, again for 3 to 5 seconds, so that his head is directly above his tail. Carefully cupping the pup in both hands, reverse the direction so that his head is pointing straight down, and hold again for 3 to 5 seconds. Dropping the puppy is not advisable for optimum brain development, so do this carefully. Next, hold the pup so that he is parallel to the floor, belly up, for the same amount of time as the other exercises. Last, put the pup on a cold, damp towel for 3 to 5 seconds, and then return him to the litter. Carmen Battaglia, a PhD scientist and American Kennel Club judge, who has written extensively about this plan, cautions that breeders should follow it exactly. He suggests that repeating the exercises more than once a day or doing them for more than 5 seconds each can potentially cause harm. This does not mean that you should restrict the normal cuddling and handling that every puppy needs, and most of us can't resist giving. The exercises described involve stimulation that pups would normally never get and possibly act to kick-start some aspects of neurological development. Because too much stress can backfire, if you're going to try this out, I'd suggest doing it exactly as described. I used the plan on one litter, and the pups did grow into calm, resilient dogs, but that doesn't tell us much because who knows how the litter might have turned out otherwise. Maybe they would have been the same, or maybe they'd have been better if I hadn't done the exercises. However, the research suggests that the exercises do have value, and they are an important reminder to us of the effect of the environment on your pup's brain. The exercises are designed to stimulate the senses that are fully functioning at birth, the sense of touch, another sense called proprioception, which involves the brain knowing where the body is in space, and the ability to sense warmth or cold. Once the eyes and ears of puppies are functioning, starting around 14 days or so, they need stimulation in the areas that process sound and vision. That doesn't mean a pup should be bombarded with constant noise and handling. Pups, like babies, need lots of time to be left alone to sleep. But when they're awake, they need enough stimulation to encourage connections to form among neurons in different parts of their brains. Keep in mind that environmental enrichment is different from socialization, in which pups are introduced to animals with whom they are expected to form social relationships. We know from extensive research, first done by John Paul Scott and John L. Fuller in a groundbreaking 20-year study, that pups are hardwired to learn between the ages of about 5 weeks and 13 weeks what their social partners are supposed to look like and how they are supposed to behave. This time period is called a critical or sensitive period because if you miss it, you'll never quite get the same effect later on. That's one of the reasons good trainers and behaviorists encourage well-managed puppy socialization classes, so your dog's brain can record what his playmates should look and act like. This is especially important for dogs, given that they come in a dazzling array of shapes and sizes. You can hardly blame a teacup poodle for not knowing how to react to a Newfoundland if she's never met any dogs besides other poodles. Lots of people are aware of the importance of early socialization for dogs, thanks to the efforts of people like Ian Dunbar, a veterinary behaviorist who spent the better part of 25 years encouraging people to create and attend puppy socialization classes. But fewer know about the important effects of environmental enrichment on behavior. The good news is that you don't need to go too far out of your way to provide an enriched environment for a growing pup. Puppies raised in most homes hear a variety of noises, from the phone ringing, to the kids coming home from school, to advertisements on television. They are picked up and handled often, and are more likely than kennel-raised pups to be put on a variety of surfaces, amid a variety of smells. However, pups raised outside or in kennels can also get a tremendous amount of stimulation. When I was breeding border collies, the pups and their mom lived inside for 3 to 4 weeks, then moved into the old milk house in the barn. Lost in puppy rapture, I'd spend hours outside with them. I brought each one into the house daily, took them waddling through the tall grasses, and allowed them to experience all the sounds, sights, and smells of the Wisconsin countryside. What matters, whether a pup is raised inside or out, is whether he spends long days in the same place, listening to the same sounds and seeing the same things, or whether he experiences a bigger range of life's experiences. We all have our limits. Keep all this in mind if you're buying a puppy mill puppy because you fell in love with his sad, sweet eyes, or if you're rescuing an adult dog raised in compromised conditions. Far be it from me to tell you to walk away from some poor dog who's had a bad start. Just ask Bo Peep how well I did at making a cool, dispassionate decision after taking one look at her crippled little body. But for the sake of both you and the dog, I want you to be realistic about what to expect. Some dogs, probably because of superior genetics, can experience negligent, even abusive conditions and still mature into emotional health. My Luke lived an isolated and unhealthy life between the ages of 2 months and 11 months, but because of his first weeks in a healthy, enriched environment and an amazing set of genes, he developed into one of dogdom's great ambassadors. Luke adored people and dogs, and he tolerated just about anything from just about anybody. I hope you're as lucky as I was. I can't imagine ever again having a dog as noble as Luke. But for every dog like him, there are 100 whose deprivation early in life results in their inability to tolerate change or stimulation of any kind. Perhaps the Australian Shepherd you rescued, the one who lived in a cage for 3 years pumping out puppies in a puppy mill, may never be able to compete in agility despite her phenomenal physical skills. The retired racing greyhound you adopted might not be able to tolerate the cheerful pandemonium that goes along with 4 teenagers in the house. The show prospect who never left her spotless kennel until 8 months of age may never be comfortable around unfamiliar men. I'm not trying to talk you out of adopting a dog who had a tough beginning in life. The world is full of dear, damaged dogs who desperately need homes. Lots of wonderful people rescue them, and those people deserve our heartfelt appreciation. If you want to join their ranks, my hat's off to you. In spite of the importance of early development, patience and hard work can go a long way to rehabilitate dogs damaged in their youth by unsuitable environments. Just remember that this might not be the dog who wins you that obedience competition title you've always wanted. Victory with a dog who's been severely damaged by a neglectful upbringing is more likely to include finally enabling her to tolerate a house sitter when you go on vacation, rather than destroy the house or leap through the second-story window, or teaching him to walk politely down the street without leaping and snarling toward every dog he sees. Don't feel like a failure if you can't make a social butterfly out of the dog you rescued from a nightmarish beginning. Giving him a kind, loving home and helping him to relax enough to nap in your lap are achievements in their own right. If you can manage them, you deserve much more than a blue ribbon and a silver chalice. However, if what you absolutely have to have right now is a stable, easygoing dog who is adaptable to a changing environment, then you'd be wise to take this chapter to heart. Funny I'd use that phrase, to heart, when writing a chapter about the brain. I doubt that the decision I made about bringing home Bo Peep was actually made in the chambers of my heart. That organ was too busy thumping away, pumping blood to the energy-hungry nerve cells inside my head. We may speak of the heart as the center of our emotions, but as we all know, emotions actually come from our brains. The brain is a kind of emotional master of ceremonies, and this is, yet again, something that we share with our dogs. Learning a bit more about how the brain works, once it's fully formed, can go a long way toward helping us understand the emotional connection between us and our dogs. Brain basics. The complexity of a fully formed brain, whether it's yours or your dog's, is absolutely astounding. A piece of your brain no bigger than a grain of sand has 100,000 nerve cells in it. Each microscopically small nerve cell, called a neuron, is still big enough to connect with thousands of other neurons. It is these vital connections that are lacking in animals raised in sterile environments. In total, your brain contains over 100 billion neurons, with 10 trillion connections between them. Heaven only knows how many of those connections are being used as you read this, but if you tried counting them one by one, you couldn't finish in a lifetime. Speaking of lifetimes, it would take 44,000 of them to count the sum total of all the connections between nerve cells in your brain. I don't know about you, but facts like this evoke the same feeling in me that I get when I look up at the stars at night. I don't care how many neurons we have, there aren't enough to handle the concept of 10 trillion, much less that of infinity. All these connections allow the brain to act as a filter, a switchboard, a maintenance crew, and a board of directors. It weighs a total of 3 pounds in a 150-pound human, and about a fifth of a pound in the head of a beagle. The brains of humans are huge compared to our body weight. The brain of a gorilla weighs only a third as much as ours, while a gorilla's body weight is 2 to 3 times that of a human. Even a whale's brain weighs only about 4 times as much as ours, when a whale's body weight can be more than 400 times greater than ours. No doubt about it, our brains are phenomenally large. Even if your dog is a genius, his brain is proportionately tiny compared to yours. No matter how smart your dog is and how much you love him, the fact of the matter is that your brain, in some important ways, is different from his. These differences are important, and we'll talk more about them in a later chapter. However, for all the differences between the size and function of our brains and the brains of our dogs, the similarities between them are amazing. Canine and human brains are made up of the same basic structures, and they function the same way. The brains of all animals are made up of neurons, their tangle of connections, and a supportive scaffolding that provides structure and nourishment to the hard-working nerve cells. It turns out that it takes a lot of energy to keep all this activity running smoothly. It also turns out that the energy required to power your brain has an important effect on emotions. The hungry brain. Brains are energy guzzlers. In humans, they use 25% of the body's oxygen and many of the body's available calories. This hunger for energy means that blood flow is increased to areas of the brain that are actively working, as the blood brings fuel to the busy nerve cells. Thanks to new technologies like PET scans and fMRIs, we can track changes in blood flow, observe which neurons are active or passive, and thus know which parts of the brain are engaged when you're petting your dog, listening to music, or watching a monster in a scary movie. That ability has radically changed our understanding of how the brain works. Much of our new knowledge about brain function is based upon the brain's hunger for fuel and upon our ability to observe how energy is distributed while the brain is working, which of course is all the time. The energy requirements of the brain are impressive. Our brains are indeed remarkable things, but they come at a high price. Think of them as the SUVs of organs, requiring disproportionately large amounts of energy compared with the rest of the body. No wonder we get so tired when we're learning something new. How many times have you said you weren't physically tired, you were mentally tired? It turns out that both states are physical in nature, part and parcel of the same basic process, you just feel them in different ways. It all gets down to energy in, energy out. If too much goes out because your brain is working harder than usual, you feel it in your mind rather than your muscles. This is vital information for those of us who need an Arctic outfitter to walk our dogs in January, or who have high-energy dogs of herding breeds and yet no flock of sheep in the garage. You can spend half an hour teaching your dog some new tricks and get almost the same effect as if you've walked her for an hour. Keep it lighthearted and fun, use lots of positive reinforcement, and try hard to motivate your dog to want to learn. Of course, your dog is still going to need some physical exercise, but the combination of the two will go a long way to keep Maggie from munching on your couch or bouncing off your walls. The downside of all this is that your dog can get mentally overtired, just like you can. Remember those frowning dogs we talked about in the last chapter, the ones whose faces signaled that they were running out of patience? I've seen hundreds of them, I'm afraid. Dogs who had been doing wonderfully at the family picnic or during the New Year's Eve party, but ruined the occasion by snapping at someone as the festivities were winding down. Many of these dogs were good dogs who, I believe, didn't want to hurt anyone. They were simply exhausted, not just from running or swimming all day long, but from the constant stimulation of being in a crowd of people. The dogs simply ran out of steam, and ultimately out of patience. Keep in mind that your dog needs you to protect him from mental as well as physical exhaustion. It's a wise and loving owner who gives his dog a break long before she's had enough. Two kinds of traffic. All mammals, including you and your dog, use a combination of electricity and chemistry to move signals around inside our heads. A neuron that's been turned on by something, from the touch of a nose to the sound of a bark, sends an electrical signal down its connections toward other neurons. In a human, the sum total of all this mental electricity is the equivalent of a 10-watt light bulb, a pretty impressive amount, if you think about it. Electricity isn't enough to move information through the brain because the thread-like extensions of neurons that stretch toward other neurons don't physically connect. The gap between them is tiny, but electricity can't jump across it. Chemicals called neurotransmitters bridge the gap, moving through fluid from the end of one thread-like connection to another. As soon as the connecting fiber receives these chemicals, electricity takes over again. It moves the signal through the next neuron and down another connecting fiber until it comes to another gap, where the neurotransmitters take over again. This alternation of electricity and chemistry is happening right now, billions of times, at blinding speeds in both you and your dog. No wonder we can get tired just sitting at a desk all day. The chemical messengers that travel between neurons do far more than move signals from one cell to another. They are vital to how you and your dog feel at any given time. In the last 30 years, we've learned that neurotransmitters such as serotonin and dopamine have a profound effect on our emotions. Serotonin acts to dampen feelings of fearful arousal and is associated with the experience of pleasure and contentment. That's why so many depressed people benefit from mood-elevating drugs that increase the amount of serotonin available to the cells in their brains. Dopamine plays an equally important role in feelings of pleasure and addictions. The roles these chemicals play are complex. Many of them have complicated job descriptions that we haven't begun to sort out. Dopamine, for example, is vital to your brain's ability to focus your attention. Its release causes all your brain cells to cease firing for a microsecond and then prepares them to fire in anticipation of an important event, but it's also a key player in feelings of reward and satisfaction. Neurotransmitters aren't the only chemicals in your brain that affect mood. Hormones move through the bloodstream rather than between the cells of our brains and have a profound effect on emotion. For example, the release of the hormone oxytocin causes the uterine contractions that are vital during the birth of all mammals, but it also affects our emotional state. As we'll see in more detail in a later chapter, if you feel all warm and soft when you pick up a puppy, it's because your body is being flooded with a wave of oxytocin. Surges of oxytocin lead to strong feelings of love and attachment and are so important that mothers who don't produce them can have problems bonding with their children. Some people find this connection between a hormone and a feeling upsetting, as if the existence of a chemical basis of love demeans the emotion. To me, it's yet another example of the wonder of biology and how we have to stop thinking of our brains, our emotions, and our bodies as separate. We'll talk more about neurotransmitters and hormones in the chapters about fear, anger, happiness, and love, but for now, what's important is that these same chemicals play an equivalent role in the brain and the body of your dog. The evidence is overwhelming that other mammals, including our dogs, produce the same chemicals in their brains, and that these chemicals have much the same effect on them as they do on us. Indeed, our knowledge about the function of these substances comes largely from work done on other mammals. Healthy levels of serotonin have been found to inhibit aggression and encourage friendly social behavior in many species of animals, including humans, non-human primates, and rats. Sheep who have been given a drug that blocks the action of oxytocin reject their own lambs as soon as they are born. Dopamine plays an important role in addictive behavior in rats and monkeys, just as it does in humans. Keep this in mind when someone argues to you that dogs don't have emotions. Not only do dogs show the same changes in facial expressions and posture that humans do, but their internal brain chemistry appears to parallel ours as well. The chemistry that controls our emotions is found in similar contexts and similar areas of the brain in dogs. Oxytocin appears to have the same effect on dogs as it does on us, not only stimulating uterine contractions, but also facilitating bonding and nurturance. There is a growing body of research that correlates certain types of aggression in dogs with low levels of serotonin. This evidence replicates some of the findings in human neuropsychology. Hyper-anxious dogs appear to suffer the same chemical imbalances that extremely anxious people have. Of course, I'm not arguing that dogs and humans have exactly the same emotions or that they experience them in exactly the same way. But as our ability to understand the biology of emotion increases, it is becoming increasingly clear that in many ways, dogs may be more like us than they are different from us. Navigating the brain. The basic structure of your brain is also similar to the structure of your dog's. Both humans and dogs have brains that come in three main sections. 1. The hindbrain, comprising the brainstem and cerebellum, which keeps our lungs breathing and our bodies aligned in space. 2. The midbrain, which regulates our emotions and memory formation. And 3. The forebrain, made up of 2 cerebral hemispheres covered with a thin film of cells called the cortex. It's this area of the brain that we think of as the center of thought and decision-making, and, not surprisingly, it's this area that is most different in people and dogs. Of course, things are much more complicated than that, but it's still helpful to start with the basics, and the basics are something we all share with our dogs. No matter what you and your dog are doing right now, the brain stems sitting atop your spinal cords are efficiently sending out signals to the lungs and the heart. Breathe. Beat faster. Pretty important stuff, that. Imagine if you had to stay up at night to tell your lungs to breathe. I'd forget my head if it wasn't attached. Is true for many of us. Good thing our heads are attached, or we'd get too busy to remember to breathe. If we could misplace our brain stems as we do our keys, natural selection would have gotten rid of us a long time ago. We tend to forget these basic functions, instead thinking of the brain only as the center of thought and problem-solving. We don't call someone brainy because his heart and lungs work so well, but without these ancient areas of the brain, you and your dog wouldn't make it through the night. Ever wonder why dogs who like to hunt small animals grab them by the back of the neck and shake them? That's where the brain stem is, and serious damage to this part of the brain is fatal, pure and simple. It's the reason my blood ran cold when a couple told me that their dog had grabbed a child by the back of the neck and wouldn't let go. At the time, they were relieved that the dog hadn't harmed the child's face. I was sick with the knowledge that this could have been a killing bite or could have paralyzed the child for life if the spinal cord had been severed. In 17 years, I've had only two other cases where a dog bit a child at the back of the head and shook the neck. In one case, the child made it through with minor injuries. In the other, the child was killed. Besides regulating vital body processes, the ancient part of the brain also contains an area that coordinates movement, the cerebellum. When you reach down to pet your dog, your cerebellum is the stage manager that keeps things running smoothly. When you stop petting and your dog nudges you for more, his cerebellum coordinates the movement. It's not surprising that this primitive part of the brain is integrally involved in movement because it's movement that created the need for brains in the first place. Animals wouldn't need a brain if all they had to do is just react, as claimed by the neurosurgeon mentioned in Chapter 1. Plants just react all the time. For example, acacia trees release airborne chemicals that signal danger if a browsing antelope chomps on their leaves. The surrounding trees of the same species receive the message and quickly change their internal chemistry so that their leaves become less tasty. It's movement from one place to another that requires a brain. If an animal is going to move, it has to make choices that immobile animals don't. What is it about to move into? Should it move this way or that way? The proof is in an animal called a sea squirt, which has a brain and nerve cord while it's swimming around in the ocean. When it matures and permanently anchors itself to a rock, its brain is absorbed and digested by the rest of the body. No movement, no brain necessary. Surely those of us who have spent just a little too long lying on the couch in front of some tawdry television show can relate to a lack of motion leading to brain absorption. It's midnight. Do you know where your toes are? Your dog does. It's a good thing that these ancient areas of the brain coordinate many of your movements, for it ensures that much of what your body is doing is controlled outside the realm of conscious thought. Your brain knows exactly where your toes and elbows are every instant of your life, but you're not consciously aware of this information unless you go out of your way to be. A circuit of signals runs between your muscles, your inner ear, and your cerebellum to keep you aligned in space, including being in the position you're in right now, without the need to think about it. Imagine being conscious of the location of every part of your body every moment of every day. Just thinking about it is tiring, and for good reason. Decision-making and conscious thought take place primarily in the newer part of your brain, the cortex, which is famous for being an energy hog that requires a disproportionate amount of fuel to run. Better then to save the cortex for things that can't be relegated to the cerebellum and not bother our pretty little heads unnecessarily. The cerebellum acts like the autopilot system in a plane, enabling us to fly without consciously monitoring every little movement, every single second. It's this phenomenon that explains why teaching your dog new tricks can do almost as much to tire her out as taking her on a walk. When she's learning something new, she can't run on autopilot out of her energy-conserving cerebellum. She has to use her brain's energy-guzzling cortex, so a little bit of something new can tire her out as much as a long walk around the neighborhood. If that's the only thing you learn from this book, it still might be worthwhile because so many of our dogs have excess energy that gets them into trouble. We all know that dogs need exercise, but it's easy to forget that they need mental as well as physical exercise. I put physical in quotes because, as I mentioned earlier, mental processes are just as physical as those that take place in our muscles, even though we don't tend to think of them that way. Chris and Custer were a great pair, both young, healthy males who reveled in playing ball, running hard, and relaxing together on their old, musty couch. I met Custer first, all 80 pounds of him, lunging his way toward me, dragging his human behind him. "Isn't he great?" Chris beamed. And he was. Custer greeted me with the full body wag, squinty eyes, and the open, relaxed mouth of a dog who loves people. After Custer and I had a love fest on the living room floor, I asked Chris why he'd requested an appointment. "Well, he's a great dog, but he's not very good at listening to me. I've taken him to obedience classes, but he still won't sit or stay when I ask him to, and he's too big to get too much older without some manners." I agreed. Since Custer was only 8 months old and already capable of flattening anyone smaller than a Green Bay Packer defensive end without even trying. "Why don't you ask him to sit and stay for me," I asked, "so I can get an idea of how things are going." Chris asked Custer to sit, and sit he did, at least for about half a second, until Chris said, "Stay." As soon as he did, Custer leapt up, kissed Chris's face, and joyfully danced around his owner. They repeated this exercise 3 times, and each time, Custer sat for an instant and then jumped to his feet as soon as Chris said stay. However, when I tried it, Custer not only sat as directed, he stayed in place for a solid 3 to 4 seconds before I released him. A stay that short might not seem impressive, but given Custer's propensity to hurtle into the air as soon as he heard the word stay, it seemed like a significant improvement. Certainly, Chris thought so. "I've been trying for 5 months to get him to do that. How the heck did you get him to stay still?" It would have been great fun to answer that I've always had a special way with dogs, not true, and that even as a child my friends called me the dog whisperer, even less true. But the answer was far more mundane. The only difference between Chris and me was the movement of our bodies when we said stay. Like most people, Chris hadn't learned to pay attention to the movements of his body when he was saying stay. When he did, he unconsciously moved backward a few inches and ever so slightly bowed forward with his torso. That was exactly the same set of movements I'd seen him perform earlier when he called Custer to come. Custer was doing what he was told, but was paying attention to Chris's body, not his voice. Once Chris learned to match his movements to his voice, Custer was able to sort out stay from come in a couple of days. The sport of dog training. The efficiency of the cerebellum, which allows many of our actions to be unconscious, has a price, and our dogs are often the ones who pay for it. The fact that we can be oblivious to the position and movements of our body makes life difficult for our dogs. Living with aliens who speak another language, our dogs are desperately watching our bodies to get information about what we expect of them. Because we usually aren't paying conscious attention to how all our body parts are moving, we send confusing and inconsistent signals out on a daily basis, while our dogs have smoke coming out of their ears trying to figure us out. As I wrote in The Other End of the Leash, the biggest difference between dog lovers and professional dog trainers is that the pros know exactly what their bodies are doing when they're working with a dog, so they don't confuse their dogs with random and inconsistent movements. That's why I think of dog training as a science, a sport, and an art, and it's the sport part that everyone can learn if they are willing to practice a little bit. If you want to be less confusing to your dog and have a better behaved dog as a result, put your cerebellum on hold for a while and use your cortex to monitor your movements. Focus your attention for a few weeks on how you move in space when you're working with your dog. You could even have someone videotape you, as suggested in the first chapter. The reason it's so shocking to see ourselves on video for the first time is that so much of how we move is out of the realm of conscious thought. Your friends might know that you put your hand over your mouth or play with your hair while you talk, but you probably don't. Be assured, though, that your dog does, because she's been watching you like a hawk for years. When you think about it, why should we know what we look like from the outside in? How could our brains record what we look like from 10 feet away? That would be like asking a camera to take a picture of itself. There's tremendous variation in people's awareness of their own body movements. If you don't believe me, just go to a beginning family dog training class. Some people can quickly switch their attention to how they are moving and with little effort start giving their dogs clear and consistent visual signals. Others have no awareness of how they're moving their body, no matter how hard they try to focus on it. Lesson after lesson, you can coach them, and lesson after lesson, they can't stop a hand or a leg from moving forward at the wrong time. It can be frustrating to coach someone like this, although surely not as frustrating as being the person whose body seems to have a mind of its own. But everyone can learn how to increase their awareness of how their body moves. It just takes some people longer than others. A good example of the fact that all brains have the same general structure and function, but every one of them works a bit differently. Don't despair if you're slower than others to increase your body awareness. You may well be more adept at some other aspect of dog training. It's good for old dogs to learn new tricks. Whether you need a little coaching or a lot, don't feel too bad about your initial lack of awareness of your body's movements. Your dog has the same problem. He, too, has an inner ear and cerebellum that work together to tell the primitive part of his brain where his body parts are in space. Just like you, he isn't always aware of where his body parts are. Perhaps that's why it's so much easier to teach a dog an action than a position. Say, sit, and most dogs will behave as though it means go to your owner, face her, and move part of your body down toward the ground. Those are actions controlled by the cortex, not postures controlled by the unconscious cerebellum. Say, sit, to a sitting dog, and there's a good chance he'll lie down, which suggests that the signal relates to an action he makes consciously, rather than a posture he's in that he's not really thinking about. There are other examples of both dogs and people being unaware of their body's positions in space. Many dogs behave as though they have no idea of the location of their back feet. Of course, they couldn't function if part of their brain didn't know, but put a novice dog on a narrow wooden beam in an agility course, and he's likely to carefully place his front paws in the center of the beam and then let his back paws go helter-skelter, sometimes straight off the beam and into thin air. Most of the time, dogs don't have to think about where to put their back feet. Following in the general direction of the front feet is usually all that's necessary, so that's a reasonable thing to delegate to the inner ear and cerebellum. It might be good for your dog to become aware of her body in new ways. We know that one way to keep human brains healthy is to exercise them by asking the brain and the body to learn new things. Although most of the connections between your brain cells are formed early in life, we've recently learned that you can form new links among neurons by engaging in activities that are new to you. We're advised as we age to do novel things like use our non-dominant hand more often than usual, learn to dance, or learn to play the piano, all actions that engage both our thinking cortex and our cerebellum. There's no biological reason to believe that learning's not equally beneficial to your dog. If your dog is older, you probably won't want to introduce her to the athletic rigors of agility, but dogs of almost any age can learn new tricks. At 15, my oldest dog, Pip, loves learning new tricks. She may be hard of hearing and a bit wobbly on the stairs, but she just learned to lay her head down on the ground between her front paws when I say, "Bummer." And I swear, she gets as much of a kick out of it as I do. Emotion Central. As we've already seen, the brain is a complicated, integrated piece of work, and all parts of it seem to play some role in our experience of emotion. However, there's little question that the part of the brain called the midbrain is the command center of emotion in both you and your dog. Nestled between the cerebellum and the wrinkled lobes of the cerebral hemispheres and cortex, this area of the brain has a profound effect on how you and your dog experience the world. The structures within the midbrain make up what's called the limbic system, which drives most of your emotions. Your eyes and ears send information to your brain about what's happening, but the small structure called the amygdala assigns emotional significance to that information. Did you just see an aggressive dog running toward your own? Oh no! Signals your amygdala as soon as it receives the information and relays the emotions of fear and arousal to another structure in the limbic system, the hippocampus. This area integrates the information with stored memories of other events, perhaps a dog who looked much the same attacked your dog last year, and then passes the filtered and emotion-laden information to your decision-making brain, the cortex. In a fraction of a second, electricity sizzles and chemicals rush between millions of your brain cells, concluding with signals to your muscles to take action. All this happens in the blink of an eye, but it still takes some time for the information to be moved from your body's sensory systems through several different areas of your brain and back to the muscles of your body with instructions for action. But what if you have very little time, as little as half a second? That's when another important actor in the limbic system kicks in, the hypothalamus. It's called the brain of the brain because it regulates so many of your body's functions without involving your energy-hungry cortex. Once it receives information, the hypothalamus can directly signal your adrenal gland for fight or flight, while skipping the circuitry that runs up the rest of your brain. Years ago, I was bitten by a dog who lunged directly at my chest. One moment I was walking past him, and the next I was watching him bite back and forth along my forearm, which had appeared as if by magic in front of my chest. What's relevant here is that I couldn't have had time to make a conscious decision to move my forearm to protect my body. It just happened, thanks to the quick work of my hypothalamus, my adrenal glands, and my cerebellum. All the structures in the limbic system play a central role in the experience of emotion in both you and your dog. The limbic system is where neurotransmitters are most concentrated, acting in conjunction with structures like the amygdala to control your emotional life. Your dog has exactly the same set of structures, permeated with the same set of neurotransmitters. This part of the brain is commonly called the mammalian brain because it is first seen in mammals and is absent in reptiles. It may not have been around for as many millions of years as the brainstem and the cerebellum, but it's been around for quite a while, and it's considered a relatively primitive set of structures. It is not the part of the brain that is unique to humans. We share it with other mammals, including the one who may be lying at your feet as you read this book. This is yet another reason why biology suggests that dogs do experience emotions. Surely they don't experience them exactly as we do. The cognitive component of emotion, which we'll talk about later, makes our experience of emotion somewhat different from our dogs. But to argue that they don't share the basics of fear, anger, and joy is to argue against biology as we understand it. We all produce our own reality shows. So far, we've been talking about the similarities between human and canine brains, but some parts of our brains are profoundly different, and they deserve our attention as well. The biggest difference between your brain and that of your dog is in the last major section of the mammalian brain, the big gray cerebral hemispheres. These hemispheres, in humans as wrinkled as a wizened old woman, are covered by a thin layer of cells called the cortex. This is where we do most of our thinking and planning, and it's also the feature that makes our brains so disproportionately large. It's the cortex that ultimately receives information from the sensory system, and that informs the brain what it's seeing, hearing, smelling, and feeling. It's in the cortex that each of us constructs our perception of the world around us, and because each of us has a different cortex, each of us lives in a slightly different world. That's partly because the brain of every mammal, including humans and dogs, is designed to perceive and react to only some of the information available to it. Just as reality shows on television are highly edited, so that they present only a portion of what really happened, our brains are always editing out information and keeping only a portion of it for processing. What your brain tells you about the world around you is not a complete picture. It has been edited to keep you from being so overloaded with information that you have a mental meltdown. Even 100 billion brain cells aren't enough to process every single piece of information available to you. Partly on the basis of genetics, partly on the basis of experience, your brain edits out things judged to be unimportant. Perhaps the sound of the fan you've had in your home for 3 years, or the sight of the marks where your dog chewed on the table leg when he was a pup. Better to expend your limited brain power to listen for the sound of your dog pacing because he has diarrhea, or to notice that his water bowl is empty. Because of the editing function of the brain, every person and every dog sees the world a little differently. This is why law enforcement officials struggle to get accurate descriptions at crime scenes. It's not just that people aren't particularly observant of the kind of details that become important in crimes. It's that we actually record different things. Our brains are making continuous split-second decisions about what to attend to and what to ignore, and each brain makes a slightly different set of decisions. Some of those decisions are driven by emotional memories stored deep in the limbic system and can vary greatly depending on what has happened to an individual during his or her lifetime. Some are based on genetics and on how the individual is hardwired before and after birth. One dog will respond to the approach of a stranger as a life-threatening experience, while another interprets exactly the same event as a party about to happen. Both you and your dog, consciously and unconsciously, make decisions and judgments millions of times a day about what should be filtered out, about what deserves your attention, and about how it should be evaluated. Because of that, no matter how close we are to our dogs, we'll never really live in quite the same world as they do. This is, of course, also true of you and your parents, your partner, and your absolute best human friend in the entire world. There's another reason that each of us lives in our own reality, and is particularly important in comparisons between different species. Not only do our brains filter out different kinds of information, they receive different information in the first place. Though we share the same planet, the sensory systems of animals vary so much that we might as well be living in different worlds. Bees can see bullseye-shaped ultraviolet lines on flower petals that direct them to the pollen, when all we see is the pretty red color of the petal, and dogs can't distinguish the red flower from the green grass because they're red-green colorblind. In pitch darkness, bats navigate by bouncing sound waves off objects in the landscape. Dogs would be using their noses to navigate, and people would be standing stock still, unable to locate much of anything at all. Some fish can sense electromagnetic currents, of which people, and most probably dogs, are completely unaware. These comparisons are more than just intellectually interesting in a golly gee sort of way. They are relevant to our shared experience of emotion because it turns out that many of our senses are closely connected to our emotions. Like us, dogs use sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch to interpret the world around them, but as we all know, they experience each of those senses differently from us. Vision is the most important source of information to primates, so not surprisingly, we humans devote an inordinate amount of our sensory cortex to it. A casual look at our language illustrates the importance of sight to us. We say, "I see what you mean," and, "Look, what I'm trying to tell you is..." Vision is such an integral part of how we see the world that I've inadvertently referred to it twice in the last few lines. A casual look at our language and how we see the world. I didn't use those words on purpose to make my point. I didn't even notice that I'd written them until I reread the paragraph. I used them because that's the way we describe the world, through the principal sensory system of primates, vision. Through your nose only. Dogs rely on vision too, but if a dog were writing this book, surely she'd be writing, "How we smell the world," and, "Sniff, I told you never to get into the garbage when your humans are home." We all know that a dog's sense of smell puts ours to shame. It's been estimated that dogs can use their noses 1,000 to 10,000 times better than we can. We may be structured to have impressive powers of abstraction and problem solving, but dogs are the ultimate smell machines. Not only do they have a nose designed to take in as many scent molecules as possible, can you move your nose from right to left? They have a much larger surface area inside the nose to absorb scent molecules. Once the smells are received, they travel to the sensory cortex, which is proportionately huge in dogs. Their ability to experience the world through their noses means we'll never really know what the world is like to them, because so much of what they perceive is beyond us. Think of using scent to locate the one stick among dozens of others that you picked up and threw for your dog last week. Your dog can do it, even after the stick has been lying in the sun and the rain for 6 days. Dogs are so good at finding and identifying smells that we simply can't imagine how the world appears to them. This difference in perception goes beyond dogs' ability to smell tiny quantities of something that would be imperceptible to us. Dogs can distinguish between scents to an extraordinary degree. When you pet a damp, dirty dog, you can easily recognize the smell of wet dog, but you can't separate out the smell of the water from the smell of mud on his paws, and the dander in his coat, and the scent glands behind his tail. And when you walk into someone's house for dinner and are overwhelmed with the good smell of homemade chicken soup, you smell chicken soup, but your dog smells chicken and carrots and onions, each as separate as they are when you look into the pot. If you see 5 objects on a blanket, your brain doesn't perceive them as a mixture of images. It sees them as 6 separate things, 5 objects and a blanket. That's what scientists think dogs can do with smells, separate them out, each from the others, rather than blending them together. We're so good at separating things visually that we take it for granted, But imagine being able to do that with smells. What a different world it would be. Comparatively pathetic, though, our olfactory abilities are, scent still plays an important role in our lives. Much of the information about scent that we are able to perceive is relayed not to the conscious part of our brain, but to that ancient limbic system that drives emotions, mood, and memory. That's true for both dogs and us, and it means that the sense of smell has more effect on humans than you might think. Pheromones, a category of scent molecules that we take in but aren't conscious of, can change our sexual appetites, cause a man's beard to grow faster, help mothers recognize their baby's t-shirts merely by sniffing them, and cause men to rate women as more attractive. In both people and dogs, the sense of smell is more closely linked with emotion than any other of the senses besides touch. Except for touch, smell is the most primitive sense, and its connections go directly to the more primitive and emotional parts of your brain. We've all had experiences in which we were flooded with emotion when we smelled the perfume worn by an old flame or caught a whiff of grandma's cinnamon buns. This is because, unlike the nerves that relay information about sight and sound, the olfactory nerves go straight to the emotional part of your brain, bypassing all the other departments usually visited by our sensory perceptions before they go to the limbic system. This is true of dogs, too. And given their amazing abilities to use their noses, I often wonder if we could be using scent more effectively to communicate with our dogs. One way in which many of us are doing that already is by using food as reinforcement in training. Food is a great motivator to both people and dogs, and is a great way to teach dogs both basic obedience like sit and stay, and advanced tricks like rolling themselves up in a blanket when you say go to bed. This isn't just because food tastes good. In fact, dogs don't have taste buds as sophisticated as ours. It's also because food has strong odors associated with it, and the sense of smell is directly linked with the areas associated with pleasure or disgust in the limbic system. Indeed, the smell of food is so closely linked with primitive emotional centers that neurologists believe the limbic system first evolved as a way of evaluating whether food was good for you or would make you sick. Good smells equaled good food, which made you feel good. Bad smells equaled bad food, which made you feel bad. Simple as that. Now, of course, things aren't so simple, but both you and your dog are still strongly affected by what you smell. If your dog learns to associate the good smells of food with sitting when you ask, then you're teaching his brain to feel good when he listens to you. This is one of the reasons you can use food to get a behavior started, and then drop it out once the behavior has become a habit. You don't need to carry dog treats around in your pocket for the rest of your dog's life, because you've wired his brain to associate listening to you with feeling good. If, on the other hand, you train primarily using force, perhaps you use a leash correction to make your dog sit, you're missing out on a remarkable opportunity to condition a primal, positive association between obedience to you and his reaction to good food. Additionally, if you use force, you're probably stimulating the fear centers in his limbic system so that he learns to associate you with the potential of danger. It's a shame how common it is for people to use force and coercion on their dogs, when there's no question that positive techniques, besides being more humane, are simply more effective. One of the important roles of the limbic system is not just to assign an emotional state to an event, it's to record those associations in an immediately accessible place. Even though we may not be as good at using our noses as dogs are, we can relate to the strong connection between smell and emotional memories. Perhaps the scent of pine brings back the happiness you felt every summer when your parents took you camping. You might notice a perfume you haven't smelled in years and remember your first love as an adolescent. Of course, these associations are not always good ones. The smell of champagne brings back the day I combined my first hangover with my first sailboat ride on the open ocean. 40 years later, all I need is one sniff of champagne and my stomach begins pitching like a ship in a storm. I've always wondered whether the relationship between smell, memory, and emotion explains a confusing kind of case related to dog-dog aggression. Behaviorists see a small but consistent percentage of aggression cases in which dogs appear to be acting like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. At first, they send out the signals of friendliness while greeting another dog, wagging from the shoulders back, mouth open, eyes relaxed. This continues until the dogs have greeted one another for a second or two, and then our previously slap-happy dog explodes, growling, lunging, and sometimes attacking and injuring the other dog. You can imagine how confusing and frightening this is to owners, not to mention the other dog, and I've been perplexed by it for years. I have an inkling that it's related to smell. The only pattern I can find in these cases is that the dog's friendly demeanor always changes right after he or she has gotten a good whiff of the other dog's anal genital region. That suggests the dog's reaction is related to smell, although I'm not sure this hypothesis will help us to understand it better. We have so much to learn about the world of scent that our dogs live in, we don't even know what information they obtain when they sniff one another, or when they smell urine deposited by others as scent marks. Can they sense the emotional state of a dog from his urine? It's a reasonable possibility, given how the body's chemistry and physiology change as our emotions change, but we don't really know. We do know that there is another relationship between smell and emotions that doesn't rely on memory or any kind of learning. Certain odors seem to have inherent effects on us, no matter what our early experience. The scents from the oils of some plants appear to improve our mood by changing our brain's chemistry, so that it produces proteins that tend to make us feel good. Lavender, for example, is known for producing feelings of calm and well-being in those who smell it. Even babies in nurseries sleep better and longer when the scent of lavender is in the air. There's no reason that scent wouldn't have an equally important effect on your dog. One practical application of the relationship between smells and emotions is the use of DAP. DAP stands for Dog Appeasing Pheromone, and it seems to be useful in improving the mood in some dogs who are anxious about being left home alone or are afraid of thunderstorms. It is a replicate of the pheromone produced between the mammary glands of a lactating dame and is presumably received by the pups when they're experiencing the happy feelings of getting a good meal. I've had clients who reported great success with it. Others couldn't detect any difference at all in their dog's behavior, so don't expect miracles if you try it. But it's clear that the relationship between smell, emotion, and canine behavior is an important one that we need to learn more about. We could talk about the senses of a dog for a long time, but that's already been done beautifully in other books, such as Stanley Coren's How Dogs Think. That book is a great resource for how all of your senses compare with your dog's, and I highly recommend it. What I want to emphasize here is that there are many similarities between the brains of people and the brains of dogs. We share ancient systems found in thousands of species to keep the machine of the body running as efficiently as possible. We both have structures shared by all mammals that mediate fear, anger, and joy, as well as primal drives like hunger and sexual energy. Our brains are designed to filter sensory information coming from the environment, to process that information, and compare it with memories stored in the midbrain before deciding how to respond. Certainly, our brains differ from those of our dogs in many ways, in the information that they take in, and in their abilities to form mental abstractions and to solve problems. These differences are important, but they don't override the fact that our brains and dogs' brains share much of their architecture and design. There is little question that the parts of our brains that mediate emotion are more similar in people and dogs than they are different. Your brain and the brain of the dog at your feet are amazing structures, fragile mazes of chemicals and electricity that are responsible for your fears, your occasional frustrations with each other, and the love that binds you together. Bo Peep's leg never functioned very well, but her story ends happily nonetheless. She had used her forelegs and shoulders as a young pup, and the active pathways between them and her brain allowed her to develop tremendous strength in them. She'd flip her hips the way dogs do when they lie down and pull herself forward with her massive front legs, dragging her hips behind her, her thick fur protecting her skin. She was amazingly fast and agile and could scoot up the hill faster than I could. She lived happily with the sheep all her life and I never lost an animal to dogs or coyotes again. Visitors would stop and stare dumbfounded when she flopped her way down the hill inside a flock of ewes, looking like some crazed white seal who had abandoned the ocean for green hills and the company of sheep. She protected my flock for 9 years and was as much a part of Red Start Farm as I was. She didn't know her hindquarters were supposed to work any differently than they did, and she remained sweet and cheerful her entire life. One afternoon, while working upstairs, I heard her alarm barking and looked out the second-story window. Bo Peep had caught a large stray dog in the act of running off with my only male duck. While Uncle Bert, the stud duck, squawked and flapped his one free wing, Bo Peep streaked down the hill like frothy white water in a flood, picked up the intruding dog in her huge jaws, and shook him like a rat. She released him the moment he dropped Uncle Bert, and let him run away, yipping like a cartoon dog down the center line of the road. At first, I had been frozen at the window in horror, but I finally ran down the stairs and flew out of the house to help. By the time I arrived, the dog had disappeared, and Bo Peep was gently nudging Uncle Bert back toward the barn. She licked his injured wing, then nudged him toward the barn, let him walk a few shaky steps, then lick and nudge again. I stopped in my tracks, transfixed by their slow, dance-like procession. Uncle Bert survived his injuries, but Bo Peep died a few years later of a hateful kind of cancer called hemangiosarcoma. I found her in a coma in the barn, carried her in a panic to the car, and drove like a race car driver to the vet's office. She died, never having woken up, a few days later. Her death hit me so hard I attended a group counseling session for pet loss, where I passed around photographs and told her story to sympathetic listeners. I cried buckets for days on end, and finally planted a raft of white tulips in her honor. That's where the next big white dog on the farm got her name, Tulip, named after the flowers I watered with tears for Bo Peep. It turned out to be the perfect name because Tulip is the essence of springtime, year in and year out. She is playful and shiny-eyed and so athletic that in her youth she climbed my fences the way a fireman climbs a ladder. Just calling her name, Tulip, makes me smile. She and I visit Bo Peep's gravestone every day. For a while, I didn't think there'd be room in my heart for another dog whose life was as big as Bo Peep's. Turns out, I was wrong.